Welcome to the International Press Review. We are recording this program on Tuesday, January 9th, 2024. Every month, the panel reviews the news from different regions of the world, giving the listeners a perspective of international news not often heard in the corporate mainstream media. The panelists are Yukari Miyamai. Yukari reviews the Japanese press. Good evening, Yukari.
Good evening. Konbanwa. Minasan, yoroshiku onegaishimasu.
Joe Yuhas. Joe reviews the Western and Eastern European press. Good evening to you, Joe.
Good evening, Jim. Wonderful to see you back. I'm delighted to see you. And good evening, my fellow panelists. És jó estét kívánok, kedves hallgatóinknak.
Ibrahim Kazrouni. Ibrahim reviews the Middle Eastern press. Good evening to you, Ibrahim.
Good evening, Jim. I echo Joe's sentiment. I love and happy to see you back. And as far as all other colleagues here, مساء الخير مستمعين الكرام شب خير دوستان الكرام.
And Doug Vaughn. Doug reviews the news from Central and South America as well as news from the Caribbean Basin. Good evening, Doug.
And good evening to you, my colleagues. Good to have you back, Jim. And thank you very much. Buenas noches a todos. Es un privilegio vivir en Colorado, según dicho. Aquí estoy.
Well, let's begin with news from Japan and Yukari Miyamai.
Thank you. Happy New Year, I hope. I have one particular news from Japan, which is a large, devastating earthquake, which hit Japan on New Year's Day. Earthquake hit west side of central Japan, facing Sea of Japan. Powerful tsunami rose within minutes after magnitude 7.5 earthquake, destroying a wide area of coast in Ishikawa Prefecture and Niigata Prefecture. Especially the area called Noto Peninsula in Ishikawa Prefecture, very remote and transportation access is quite limited. And that is where Shika Nuclear Power Plant is located. As I have reported for many years here, over 50 nuclear power plants have been built all around Japanese coastline. Remembering the disastrous Fukushima nuclear plant accident in 2011, people's first concern was about the safety of those multiple nuclear plants. More than 1 week later, today is the 9th, nearly 10,000 people lost homes and some people are still buried in destroyed buildings or mudslide. It is bitterly cold in this particular part of Japan in the winter. This is not the most recent number, but now we count at least 161 people dead. Hokuriku Electric Power Company is the one that managed Shika plant, Shika nuclear plant in Noto Peninsula. This particular company has been found lying in their press conference for the last week or so. Their lying have become more apparent because of the citizen journalist who has been accumulating the knowledge regarding the nuclear plant accident for the last 13 years or so. So they have more information gathering know-how, and they have pressed to get a detailed information from Hokuriku Electric Power Company, and they have been failing to communicate what is going on. The Hokuriku Electric Power Company initially told the public there is no abnormal situation after earthquake. But later, their statement on the water level within a nuclear facility, or radiation level, or a condition of a transformer, their statement have changed because they were kind of exposed for their inconsistent information. In here, there is a kind of another situation that the mainstream media has not been so competent in actually obtaining facts and data from electric power company. Plus, Japanese government response to the disaster has been unusually slow. It took 17 hours before Prime Minister Kishida finally assembled the first rescue response meeting, compared to 51 minutes it took for Prime Minister Naoto Kan 13 years ago to quickly conduct a disaster response mission for Fukushima accident. Even notoriously incompetent Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had acted on a large-scale Kumamoto earthquake in 2016 within 50 minutes. So this Prime Minister Kishida's government's response is very unusual or unnatural. They are slow setting up emergency evacuation centers or organizing a volunteer task force. So the people in the affected area do not have enough food or water supply, not enough aid supply or medical personnel, or no dispatching of self-defense force for rescue mission, and not allowing drone to fly over the area for aerial observation for a long time. And the news media had stopped reporting on the local situation closely after a few days. Also, we hear rampant sexual attacks on women and children in a crowded shelter because they don't have any protective environment for those people. So this seems to be very, very poor response. And people started to wonder if this is intentional. And also another thing is under severe condition in evacuation centers, the cult member from Unification Church and its affiliate seems to be actively trying to recruit new followers under such a devastating situation. And so I don't know. Another thing that happened is on January 3rd, a government of Taiwan had offered to dispatch their disaster response crew to help out rescue mission in Japan. Prime Minister Kishida's government declined the offer. So meantime, on January 7th, Foreign Minister of Japan had announced that Japan will contribute additional $37 million, which is about 5.3 million yen, for Ukraine, for aircraft system through NATO Trust Fund, and also offering to provide 5 gas turbine generator for winter survival. Prime Minister Kishida's government had spent more than 30 trillion yen for various aid program to foreign country while cutting social program in Japan. So this whole situation seems to be, to me, it's very dubious. I don't know what is going on. I can only guess that they feel this disaster can provide them some kind of opportunity for their own agenda or something. I do not know. So I don't want to go too much into speculation, but I want to let you know this is what's going on. So that is my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Yukari. That was Yukari Miyamai covering the Japanese press. We'll move on now to Ibrahim Kazrouni and the Middle Eastern press. Go ahead, Ibrahim.
Well, good evening, everyone. I don't know what I can say as far as Middle Eastern press. There is one theme that dominates literally all the reports that come out of Middle East, whether Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and Yemen, and the rest of them. And that is the situation in Gaza, the situation in northern part between Lebanon and the Israelis, and the recent attack. So far, 100, over 100 attack has been recorded on American bases, whether in Iraq or in Syria, with not to mention the Iraqi attack, Hashd al-Shaabi's attack on Haifa and a few other other cities in Israel. The situation in Gaza so far, the latest report estimates that there is no figure concrete, but estimates to have 35 to 38,000 children, women, and old people have been killed. Over 60 to 70 or close to 80,000 people have been injured. They claim that 60% of the infrastructure or 70% of the infrastructure has been completely demolished. Yet the Israelis have not been able to establish anything. And the scenario that all analysts are talking about is very close to the scenario of the Israeli in 2006 under Prime Minister Olmert, where they put their kind of list of desires and goals and objectives too high, and they were not able to achieve even anything from it. And at the end of the day, they had to sit down and agree to the United to the Security Council resolution of 1701. The same thing is happening now. The only difference is, and every time the Israelis or we have talked in various Israeli newspapers, whether it's Maariv or others, that look, we are not getting anywhere. And even previous former elected or military leaders, that this is the war is not leading anywhere. Huge number of people have been, Israeli soldiers have been killed, and the government has been forcing restriction orders and gagging order for the newspapers, not to mention anything about the true casualties of the Israelis. But from anecdotal reports that have been mentioned, over 1,400 or 1,600 Israeli soldiers have been killed. Huge number of high-ranking military officers. And so far, they say 12,000 Israeli soldiers have applied for what they call psychological assistance, because they are in desperate shape. As a consequence of what's going on, we have Israeli soldiers going through the only option open for them to refuse to go to war and to just stay out as much as possible. And if not, then they can kill themselves or somehow so that they would not be taken back into the theater of war. The Gazan scenario or the Gazan issue has settled down into literally killing civilians and nothing more. There is nothing left that for the Israelis to get. They already know that the number of prisoners that they have in Gaza, they cannot get it. They cannot get to them. But yet, every day there are more and more casualties in the Israeli army. But the worst issue at the moment that is causing huge amount of concern for the Israelis is the theater in the north with Lebanon. Hezbollah has been successfully able to empty a strip of land to the depth of 15 kilometers from the Lebanese border, from all settlers. Very few are still left. The day before yesterday, I was reading a report. Few of the settlers were saying, we are still living here because Hezbollah doesn't want to kick us out. Otherwise, we would have had to depart. So, and recently, today, there was a report out that the Houthi have not, I think, that said that so far, 250,000 or 350,000 settlers have applied for unemployment benefit to the government. So they are the ones that have been moved out of the north to the middle section. The recent assassination and the immediate response of Hezbollah in attacking one of the military bases in close to the Lebanese border with 62 missiles clearly agitated the Israeli commentators and said, look, for the first time in history of our this country that we have the enemy, according to them, the enemy dictates what kind of strip of land they want to be cleaned out of all the settlers, and they can target our military bases at will, and we cannot respond. The problem that they have, Israelis, even Netanyahu, I believe, has come to the realization that it's futile. There is no way they can get anything out of Gaza. But it is the Americans who are forcing them. And we see similar kind of situation with 2006, when Condoleezza Rice was insisting that the Israelis should not sign anything. And so it is what we have today. On the one hand, Biden administration through Blinken and others putting pressure on, say, the Yemenis, the Iranians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, as well as the Iraqis, and providing them with a huge incentive not to open up the theater of war and literally to be simply observers while the war in Gaza continues. Hochstein, who repeatedly gone to Lebanon, was recorded in saying that the Israelis have indicated that they are prepared to settle their differences with Lebanon and agree on a permanent border solution, border line between them, if Hezbollah is prepared or the axis of resistance in Lebanon is prepared not to attack Israelis at all. And the response from Hezbollah has been that we will give you the answer after the issue of Gaza has been settled. So the Americans are not getting anywhere. The assassinations of various leaders and bombing in Iran and others is just a desperate attack, a desperate attempt by the Americans to show that they are still trying to destabilize life in Iran. But they are paying huge amount of price in Iraq and in Syria, where their bases are being attacked by Iraqi resistance. And they are pushing for a final resolution for asking the Americans to leave Iraq in particular. I don't think they will be able to do anything about about Syria. Yemeni issue is another sort cause of problem for the Americans, which they damn if they do, damn if they don't. On the one hand, they want to neutralize the Yemenis, but and by threatening that we are going to attack this and the other, Yemenis say that after 7 or 8 years of constant bombardment by Saudis and others, there is nothing left to bombard. So we are the one who dictate how the situation should go. And as long as the Gaza issue continues, our threat against any ship that goes to Israel will continue. And we will attack any country that attacks us, whether the Americans, the British, or anybody else. Few countries have already left the so-called this group of armadas that they wanted to prevent Yemen. One of recent articles is that Hezbollah has in Lebanon has threatened that they are going to attack Gosh Dan, which is the area, very concentrated area in the bordering the Mediterranean. And it is about 1,516 kilometers square that has about 4 million population. But this section of the Israelis, it's hugely significant because it contained Kiryat Anadim, Atadim, which is the basis of technological development, the stock exchange, the diamond exchange, and the port of Ashdod, and the airport, Ben Gurion Airport, and a few other other important sites. So if if Hezbollah attacks this area, I don't think the Israelis will be able to hold themselves, no matter how much the Americans are pushing them, to not to respond to the Lebanese. But and they're going to respond. And once that response comes by attacking Dahiya, which is in Beirut, then the gloves are off, and that we are moving into sliding kind of slippery slope towards regional war that nobody anticipates. What is going to happen, how is going to be the consequence. Israelis would love the Americans to attack Iran, but I don't think Americans are in a position to attack Iran. So what we have, the Iranians know their strength, and particularly after the head of the Islamic government establishing that conference and Saudis realizing that they cannot bring everybody to agree to their point of view, Saudis took the back seat, and at the moment the possible confrontation is between two regional powers, Israelis that are really in a mess with the Iranians, that they feel belligerent and strong, and they want to impose and dictate their will. And they support, they have made it clear that they support the axis of resistance in the same manner that the Americans are supporting the Israelis. So the prediction is that nobody knows what is going to happen and how the constant negotiation with Hamas is taking place regarding some kind of resolution. Hamas insists that the only way they would agree to somehow release is when the Israelis agree to a ceasefire, complete ceasefire, and move out of Gaza, release all the prisoners that they have. And the Israelis, since 1952-53, all Israeli governments have resisted the idea of releasing all Palestinian prisoners. So at the moment, we have to wait and see. The situation in West Bank is getting out of control as well. Abbas and Fatah are no longer in control. Gaza has already created an opportunity, and Hamas created an opportunity for the West Bank to become much more militant than it used to be. But all the eyes are to the north, because Israelis have taken so many of their soldiers to the south. They really do not have enough capable resources, military resources, to be able to confront Hezbollah if Hezbollah decides to attack. And if they bring soldiers and military hardware from the south to the north, then the Hamas and the Palestinians would overwhelm whatever military personnel that will be left over there. So we are in a conundrum. The only way we can get out of it is for United States to realize that insisting on the war to continue is not going to lead anywhere.
Well,
any question?
I have a question. For Ibrahim, my understanding, and I stand to be corrected, is that it was Yemen who embargoed the entrance to the Red Sea to everybody but Chinese and Russian shipping. Is that correct?
No, I mean, this is what we have heard about. It's a good question, Joe. They have repeatedly, I've listened to the leaders of Houthis and other Yemeni military leaders. Their only concern is ships that are going to go to Israel specifically. They have not put any restriction on anyone, whether they are Americans, but any ship that they establish, they are going to provide support and supply to the Israelis. They will be targeted. That's their goal. So they are not. They haven't said anything as far as Chinese, Russian, or Iranian, or anybody else. They repeatedly have indicated that it's only the Israeli ship, or what, even if it is another country, as long as they are moving or going to Eilat to serve, to take something to Israel, they will attack.
See, I have seen headlines in European and American papers that Maersk, for example, is not cut off all shipping because they can't get their ships through the Suez Canal because the entrance to the Red Sea is blocked. So I am not trusting the newspapers. I trust you, and this is very closely related to the situation in Europe, to say the very least.
Yeah, I agree. There are reports. What the Israelis themselves immediately, when this warning came that they are going to attack the Israeli ships, they immediately, Netanyahu and others, they use this narrative of the global blockade against everybody. Now the Yemenis are literally destabilizing the trade movement within the Red Sea and going through Suez Canal for the entire world. Immediately, the Yemeni leaders responded that this is incorrect. This is fabrication. We are only targeting the Israelis or Israeli ships, or any ship which is bound for Israel to provide them, whether they are Israelis or others. We have nothing to do against everybody else. But unfortunately, part of this now creating a negative image against the Yemenis is this, that they are attacking only China. I mean, it's interesting that only Chinese and the Russians are the exceptions. I should have thought that they would have added Iranians to it. The Yemenis have repeatedly said that they are not concerned about anybody else. They are not targeting any other ship, as long as they are not Israelis or they are going to Eilat for offloading or whatever it is in Eilat that supports Israeli economics.
Well, welcome to 21st century news reliability.
It's part of manufacturing consent, Joe, remember?
I do. I also read 1984.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's move on. We just heard news from Ibrahim Kazrouni reviewing news from the Middle East. Thank you, Ibrahim.
Jim, can I make a comment? I just remembered, Yukari, if you are still listening, there was only one newspaper that went beyond Gaza and everything else and had a coverage of the Japanese earthquake and the tsunami that was, and the possible crisis that might come out of it due to this tsunami with regard to nuclear sites, and that was in Iran.
Yes, I think that is interesting phenomena in the news world.
Well, thank you, Ibrahim, for your coverage of the Middle Eastern press. And now we'll move on to Joe Yuhas reviewing the Western and Eastern European press. Go ahead, Joe.
So let me just say, as I always do, that I am not pretending to cover the entirety of news from Europe, but rather concentrate on those things that listeners in America and the Western world are not likely to see in their newspapers, websites, etc. Also, let me say that if anybody would like to get in touch with me, juhasdj@colorado.edu is a good email for me. I had sort of prepared a presentation for this evening, but then the mail came, or at least I pick up the mail around 5 o'clock this afternoon. So, about 50 minutes before we went on the air. And there was a piece of mail there that just I have to read to you all. On the top of it, there is a logo and the word SPIX. And then it says Netzkraft Movement and gives the address. And it's addressed to United People, 3893 Paseo del Prado, which is my home address here in Boulder. And United People is an organization I founded with my brother, when was it, in the 1980s or something? And my brother has since passed on. And these Netzkraft people are like a net of volunteer organizations, and they themselves are a volunteer organization around the idea of trying to use people power for peaceful purposes. And the date is simply New Year 2024. And then there is a, how should I say, the topic at the top, hope is dreaming with eyes wide open, Aristotle. Boy, we could spend a few thousand years thinking about that sentence. And then it says, dear Mr. Juhas, dear United People, we cannot choose where we are born, so it is all the more important to look at the world with our eyes wide open and to become active. Now, that's interesting because it says hope is dreaming with your eyes wide open. Second paragraph. In its risk report of 2010-23, that means the 10th month, which is
October
25, 2023, the United Nations University warns that humanity is already dangerously close to six tipping points. When these thresholds are exceeded, the effects on people and the planet will be irreversible, such as unbearable heat or the exhaustion of the groundwater supply. At the Paris Climate Conference of 2015, the industrial nations assured the developing and emerging countries that starting in 2020, they would set aside $100 billion United States dollars for climate protection every year. That promise was not kept. At the summit for a new global financing pact, in Paris in July of 2023, more promises were made to help poorer countries with climate protection. The summit ended without a single binding commitment. War has ravaged Yemen since 2015, Ukraine since 2022, and most recently has broken out in Israel and the Gaza Strip. As long as the parties to these wars believe that they can gain an advantage by waging war, the population suffers unspeakable cruelty. Innocent civilians are murdered. Where is hope to come from? It comes from people like you, the participants in the Netzkraft movement. It comes from people who see the world with their eyes wide open and still manage to look up at the sky that surrounds our common earth. Thank you for giving hope to others. We wish you all the best for the new year and send our kindest regards, Gertrude Shivalingam and Joe Beck. So I was thinking that this is as good an introduction to the year 2024, since this is where our program is today. It's our first session in the year 2024 to give a sense of impending doom, but the possibility of maybe still reversing course before we drive the train off the precipice. And how close we got to the precipice in Ukraine, how close we are to the precipice in the Middle East as far as war is concerned, goodness gracious. And how close are we to the precipice in so many other ways? What can we say at the beginning of the new year, along with this letter from northwestern Germany, from a little storefront operation, and in memory of my brother who's passed on, and who also attempted to maintain some measure of hope and then ultimately collapse. I really am not going to be the one to say how to do it. I am going to be the one to say that to give up the hope is to embrace something that is a dance with death. And I think I see the attraction of that Totentanz, dance with death, the dance of death, or for that matter, the Mephisto waltz, the idea of dancing with Satan, as open Satanism all over the world, against which there is, in fact, a very strong reaction. But that very strong reaction itself is militant in the literal sense. This can be taken in a dozen different ways. A dozen is a joke, about 5,000 different ways. And I will pick one of those. And that is to say, at its heart, it may as much be a theological struggle as it is an economic, political, and power struggle, and that in a way it is, in terms of where Ibrahim has finished, or in terms of what Yukari was talking about in her fascinating and important presentation, a question of the relationship between the secular educated elite and the religious, not as well educated, not cosmopolitan, urban and rural population. Maybe symbolically it's as much about the tension in Japan, as Yukari was talking about it, in terms of the present government there and whom it represents and its alliance with various religious sects, not to mention its possible hand in not wanting to help certain people in a disaster. Or I can more easily take it, if you like, to Israel, or for that matter, any other country in the Middle East, to be corrected by Ibrahim, or to be corrected, for that matter, by Yukari, or for that matter, to be corrected by Doug and the present situation in Latin America and the Caribbean. I can take also as an example, very easily, Israel and the tension in Israel between Tel Aviv and Yerusalem, or as the Americans would say, Jerusalem. The secular people in Tel Aviv are not in favor of this war. They are people who have two or three dogs and either one child or no children, while the people in Jerusalem are people who have five or six children and no dogs, and who take the five books of Moses quite literally. They are reading it as saying, I, the Creator, am giving you this land, which includes Gaza and the Western Bank. It's the West Bank of the Jordan. I think they're not going to stop until they either restore Eretz Israel or not. And they're willing to go any distance. And when I use the word theological, I really mean that, because the secularism that comes out of 19th century Budapest, Vienna, Prague, Berlin, St. Petersburg, Bucharest, and Paris was religiously secular. They were people enamored of science and rationality in an irrational and in a manner that is totally 100% morally committed. So I see the year 2024 from the European perspective as one in which the tide has turned enormously from secularism and quote unquote liberalism towards traditional theogony, and that this is not good news from the point of view of the tipping points, because both sides see themselves as engaged in a moral struggle to the end. Whether that's Viktor Orban in Hungary or Donald Trump in the United States, I leave up to you. But I can say that the hope that is being entertained in the letter I received this morning, for my mind, doesn't lie in either one of the two warring extremes, because they're both in their own way dancing with the devil. And I think that's just about 15 minutes, Jim, or did I go over?
I was just, yes, that's exactly where it is.
It's where it is, baby.
Joe, could I ask a question?
Only if you say please.
That goes without saying. Would you please send that letter, a copy of it, through email to at least to me, if you don't mind?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
I promise to do it.
All right. Thank you. I think that will be a good opening lecture that I have to the Jesuit in a couple of weeks.
There you go. And tell them that I am a graduate of Xavier High School, 30 West 16th Street in Manhattan, class of 1957. I got a bona fide Jesuit education.
Well, that was Joe Juhasz covering the Western and Eastern European press. And now we move on to Doug Vaughn and Central and South American News.
I will salute my colleagues, and especially Ibrahim's tour de force, both literal and figurative, of the events in the Middle East. Alarming though they may be, it's enlightening always to hear his perspective, and I wish it could be shared more broadly. I want to start off this summary of the past year in my region, Latin America and the Caribbean, with reference to something that Joe ended his remarks on. And that is this emerging religious secular divide, as he described it, which is, I believe, nowhere more visible and obvious than in Latin America. Traditionally, that is for the last 5.5 centuries, a bastion of support, indeed adoration, of the Roman Catholic Church, but increasingly fissured, not only in secular nationalist terms, ideological terms, as Joe alluded to, but within the religious denominations of Christianity itself. And you need go no further than your local downtown bus depot in order to get a grip on the events that are occurring, as increasing numbers of migrants from Central and South America, Central and South America, lately in Colorado, busloads of predominantly Venezuelan immigrants coming across the Mexican border and then being transported or deported, reported in a sense, by bus, paid for by the state of Texas, to predominantly to cities and in states that are governed by the Democratic Party rather than Texas's dominant Republicans. So the immigrants, in a sense, are a tool. But if you spend a little time talking to them as they get off the bus and try to reorient themselves to a newer environment, you'll find an interesting divide in terms of their educational and religious background. Most of these immigrants are poor. Many of them are what we would consider economic migrants in search of some relief from poverty rather than directly asylum seekers because of a fear of political persecution. Now, those categories are important mainly because of U.S. immigration law, which does not provide for a process of applying for asylum if you're a refugee from economic or other forms, such as environmental disasters, which affect local economies. However, those who apply for asylum status and claim persecution have a political hurdle to cover because the United States governments, and I use the plural, for several decades have accorded special status to those who claim to be refugees from political regimes that the United States doesn't like, regardless of the fact that other regimes, which are even more oppressive, are not accorded that same footing, if you will, in political terms in applying for status here. So we have Guatemalans, for example, who are fleeing decades of persecution and oppression in both political terrorism by their own governments, who are not given an advantage, if you will, for asylum, whereas those who leave Venezuela, where sanctions imposed by the United States have severely crippled the the local economy are automatically described as political refugees and eligible for asylum, in most cases, almost immediately, granted year-long residency permits while their applications can be processed. But an applicant from Guatemala, for example, fleeing even more difficult circumstances, both political and economic, and now the emerging climate-driven crisis of drought and extreme heat in Central America, would not have that opportunity to stay in the country. The other dimension, which seems to be emerging, but which I can only give anecdotal evidence for, is the predominance of immigrants who are from evangelical Protestant Christian sect, rather than from the traditional Roman Catholic base of Latin American population. And this is a direct result, in my opinion, having studied it pretty intensely for a number of years, of the Catholic Church in its European configuration having opted to elevate to the papacy Cardinal Wojtyla, that is the Polish cardinal known as John Paul II. And he came in with an agenda of immense support from the United States and most Western European countries, precisely because it was considered a wedge for dividing the former Soviet bloc. And in fact, it had a dramatic impact and helped contribute clearly to the demise of nominally communist or socialist regimes in alliance with the former Soviet Union in Europe. But it had a very different effect in Latin America, where John Paul II openly criticized and actually led a purge of those prelates and clergy that were affiliated with, broadly speaking, the left, that is critical of capitalism and supportive of efforts at national liberation with what was called at the time a special vocation for the poor. And as a result of these purges, and in fact the open alliance of the hierarchy of the church in Latin America with so many of the right-wing political movements, up to and including elements of the Catholic fraternal orders and organizations like Opus Dei that were directly supportive of death squads in Central America, the Catholic Church has lost considerable support and has lost many adherents throughout the region. And in the absence of that kind of religious base support, there's been a significant growth for the past four decades, and especially over the past 20 years, of evangelical Christian sects, if you will, often based on television and radio sermons, which, regardless of language, are strongly supported by similar denominations in the United States, which have a very right-wing tilt and support for what are, in essence, free market capitalist economies, where only the invisible hand of God is supposed to intervene in market relations. So you will find that an increasing number of the immigrants themselves into the United States, and especially those who are being given a proverbial leg up in seeking asylum, tend to be more likely of one of these Protestant denominations rather than of the traditional Roman Catholic Church, which is declining in both its organizational power because of declining church attendance, not only in the United States, but even in its traditionally most fervent domains in Latin America. I want to switch gears then to a little more discussion.
Just before you go,
yes,
Doug,
please.
I still remember John Paul going to Nicaragua and identifying a particular priest in the cabinet and pointing the finger to him and saying that he is, because he was supporting liberation theology in the region, and telling him that he is a path to hell. So I do remember that.
Yeah, that was probably the then foreign minister, Miguel de Escoto.
Yes.
And under the Sandinista regime. Those splits in Nicaragua and elsewhere have become even more intense. And I'll have to defer further discussion of that phenomenon. I want to briefly, in the time available, though, go through some of the material related to what's likely to happen in the coming year. It's projected by the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, which is one of these non-governmental organizations and academic institutions supported by governments in the region. And they seem to be endless in coming out with studies and hopeful predictions for the future. But in this case, ICLAC, as it's known, predicts that the growth of Latin America's economies, that is measured by gross domestic product, will be only about 1.8%. And that's down from 2.1% in 2023 on a region-wide basis. Now, why is that number of any particular importance? Well, it reflects not only that the rates of growth of these economies have declined, in part because of the lingering effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, which, contrary to popular opinion in most of the world, is still spreading and is still quite virulent in Latin America, which arguably was the region most heavily hit by the viral pandemic, especially because its existing healthcare systems are not particularly well developed, and the grotesque inequalities of income and wealth are so pernicious as to result in high levels of malnutrition and disease, compromised immune systems that left people more susceptible to infection of any kind in the first place. That was combined with the very slow rollout of vaccines and even the denial in some places along the lines of the leadership in the government of the United States before 2021, that the epidemic was something that would magically go away, that it was only a problem and confined to some areas, that the rates of transmission were exaggerated by false reports, and so on. And the biggest problem, of course, with the rollout of vaccines in this region was the fact that they were not available based on need, but rather were priced by the companies that produced them under trademark and copyright. That resulted in a relatively low rate of inoculation and the less effective but much more readily available Sinovac, produced by a consortium of state and privately owned companies in China, was the largest provider, and it proved to be somewhat less effective than the so-called mRNA virus vaccines that were made available in Europe and the United States, and only some of which were parceled out as donations to the countries that most needed them. Therefore, the epidemic spread farther and faster than it otherwise might have, and resulted in higher rates of mortality, not just hospitalizations, but deaths in the inadequate healthcare systems that prevailed. So there was a general slowdown of growth globally, and that has continued in Latin America with a decline in growth in the Chinese economy, which means less demand for the things that Latin Americans export. And so commodity prices have started to drop, and this portends very badly for Latin American economies in general. So with a projected growth of the Chinese economy of about 4.2%, much reduced from the 7 to 8% that we saw throughout the early period of the 2000s, that will be a burden, particularly on countries like Chile, Panama, Peru, Brazil, and Uruguay, which export a large amount of agricultural products, minerals, and metals, roughly accounting for 30 to 40% of those companies' exports are to China. We'll have a lot more to say about this in the run-up to the coming elections and some discussion of what the fallout is likely to be in each of these countries in our next session. If there are any further questions.
Jim, can I ask a question to Doug?
Yeah, go ahead. That's up.
Yep. Doug, I have a friend who, he is from Dearborn, Michigan, but he goes to medical school in Cuba. He was just here for the new year, and then now, yes, I think tomorrow or today, he's gone back. One of the things that we were asking him about how the Cuban health system is superior than anybody else within the region, and how they are supporting other countries. And part of it, for example, they collaborated with Iran regarding the anti-COVID vaccination, etc. And with the report that you just said regarding the COVID still being rampant in South America, couldn't the Cuban government help with them?
They have, and dramatically so. But first of all, you have to remember that the United States blocked the export to Cuba of things like needles for injection. So the vaccines could not be readily administered. And second, most of the vaccines required long-term freezing, basically temperatures that were well below what the infrastructure of Latin America was able to do. By the time the Cubans were able to develop their vaccine and distribute it throughout their own country, the pandemic had basically spread out of control, especially in places like Peru and Ecuador, where the death rates were higher than any place else in the world. So in some respects, it was not the Cubans' fault that they were unable to get the vaccine out fast enough. It was largely as the result of the ongoing 60-year sanctions against Cuba that it had to develop that infrastructure itself. But then that in turn affects the ability to roll out something as complicated as a new antiviral vaccine. So the shorter answer is they did a tremendous amount, especially in stopping the pandemic in their own country, but also with regard to the export of their virus virtually for free to places like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and others with which they have been closely aligned.
Thank you very much, Doc. Thanks.
Well, that's all the time. Thank you, Doug, for covering the news from Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean Basin. And that's all the time we have for this evening's program. I want to thank the panel for another fine job. The panelists were Yukari Miyamai, Joe Yuhas, Ibrahim Kazmirni, and Doug Vaughn. Join us again next month for another edition of the International Press Review.